Well, good evening, and thank you for joining me. My name is Dr. David Rubin. I am the chief of the section of gastroenterology at the University of Chicago, and I specialize in taking care of patients who have inflammatory bowel disease. I'm really delighted that you've chosen to learn a bit more about ulcerative colitis tonight, and I'm pleased that CME Outfitters has put together this wonderful program for you. So let's talk about treatments for ulcerative colitis. That's obviously what people want to know a lot about, and we've made some great advances in. There are a number of available therapies for ulcerative colitis, and there are more coming. These are the therapies that are in the guidelines that I'm summarizing, and I'm going to go through them briefly right now. And I want to note that we're using trade names of some of these therapies so you know which therapies we're talking about. At other parts of the presentation in a few minutes, I'll be reverting back to their generic or their compound names. So let's start with the aminosalicylates, the first one here. Those are the five ASA therapies. These are not immune suppressive. They're actually a derivative of willow tree bark, and they're related to aspirin, but they don't cause bleeding or affect your platelets. They're used as anti-inflammatories in the bowel and are approved and available for treatment of ulcerative colitis. The types of 5-ASA therapies, you may know the names mesalamine or acecol or delzecol or colazole or lialda, sulfasalazine, pentaza, rowasa, or canasa. You'll notice that many of them have the ASA in the name. These therapies have been around for a very long time. The second therapy that we would talk about is steroids, and I'm sure that most of you have heard of steroids, and unfortunately, most of you may have been on them. There are several different types of steroids available, including prednisone and another steroid called budesonide. Budesonide is unique because it is released and works predominantly on the lining of the bowel, but when it gets into the bloodstream, it's immediately cleared out of the system, so it doesn't have the side effects that prednisone does. Then we have our older drug called thiopurines, which include azathioprine and 6-MP. You may know them by the names Imuran or Purinethol. These are oral therapies that we used to use more often, but are still available and in the guidelines for treating ulcerative colitis. There are three classes of biological therapies. A biological therapy is a therapy that's made from cells in culture, and they're proteins. And they're proteins that are designed to target a specific part of the immune system. I know that the term biological therapy is sometimes scary, in part because of confusion about what they actually do, but I want to try to summarize briefly for you. The oldest biological therapy we have in ulcerative colitis and in Crohn's disease is in a class called the anti-TNF therapies. TNF is an inflammatory protein in our body, and the first one that was approved was a drug called infliximab with the trade name Remicade, and there are now several biosimilars to infliximab that are available in the U.S. market. One is called Inflectra, the other one's called Renflexis. They're all the same, the infliximab type of biological therapy. There are two other anti-TNFs available for ulcerative colitis, adalimumab, which you know as Humira, and golimumab, which you may have heard of as Simponi, or some people call it Simponi. The second class of biological therapies is the anti-integrin therapy. There's only one available for ulcerative colitis, vedolizumab, which is trade name Entyvio. An anti-integrin therapy is a biologic that actually blocks white blood cells from migrating out of blood vessels into the bowel, and it's selective just for those white blood cells that are trying to go to your gut. So it works only on the bowel and the intestinal system and not on the rest of your immune system. The third class of biological therapies, and the newest one approved for ulcerative colitis, so new that it didn't make it into the ACG guidelines because it just got approved a couple weeks ago, is called ustekinumab or Stelara. This is a biological therapy that targets two other inflammatory proteins called IL-12 and IL-23. What we believe happens with ustekinumab is that it only affects the proteins that are elevated where you have inflammation. So a little differently in that it doesn't suppress the entire immune system, but it works where there's inflammation, which makes it a targeted therapy as well. So I hope you understand when I talk about a biological therapy, we're talking about a protein that's derived from a cell line that targets a part of your immune system. There's not a big mystery to that otherwise. The reason biological therapies are given as injections or infusions is because the molecules themselves are too big to be absorbed through your small bowel as oral therapies. And because they're proteins, they would get digested in your stomach, just like your food. So they're delivered differently as injection or infusion. That's just to get the drug into your system. There's nothing magic about that otherwise. Now, we also have a newer therapy, which is what we call a novel small molecule. We call it a novel small molecule because it's new, but the small molecule part of it means that it's small enough that it gets absorbed into your bloodstream through your small intestine, just like the oral therapy of prednisone or 5-ASA mesalamine type therapies. This new small molecule is called tofacitinib, or brand named Xeljanz, and this drug was approved last year. Now, tofacitinib inhibits an enzyme related to activating white blood cells. So when this drug is in the bloodstream, it turns off inflammation by blocking an enzyme related to how our immune cells are turned on. That's how that works. And lastly, one of our treatments for ulcerative colitis that is still necessary and very effective is surgery. And we recognize that no one wants surgery unless they must need it. And we're not going to talk in great detail about surgery tonight, but it's important to always know that surgery is available. There have been different ways people have talked about positioning these therapies, and unfortunately, I can't tell you that there's a specific way the therapy should be sequenced in everyone. But there are some smart ways that we can be positioning these therapies in individual patients. You see here what is represented on the left, which is a red arrow that says, depending on how sick the patient is at presentation, is how you might choose the induction therapy, what's going to get the patient into remission. You'll also notice that on the right there is a staircase. The solid lines of the treads of the stair is meant to represent an induction treatment. And one of the principles of management is based on whatever induction treatment is used, we then choose the maintenance therapy to prevent future relapses. So for example, on the very first stair is the 5-ASA therapies, the aminosalicylates. They are very effective for induction of remission of mild or moderate colitis. And if they do their job there, they're also used for maintenance. When patients need steroids, which is the second step there, that often tells us that they're going to need to go up the stairs for a therapy that will keep them off steroids going forward. And you can see all the other treatments that I've already mentioned briefly listed there and stacked on top of each other. And that's in part because we don't quite have the markers necessary to know always which therapy we might use first. One of the ways we choose therapies is also based on whether or not the patient has extra intestinal symptoms or problems, the most common of which would be joint pain. And another way we choose our therapies is based on the patient's lifestyle and whether or not they choose or need to take a therapy that can travel with them for work, or whether they're able to take certain therapies orally or use injections because they need to be able to get to school and do other things. And sometimes we choose therapies because we have better evidence for more severe cases of colitis. So you can understand how complex this is, and I certainly appreciate that in your own discussions with your healthcare team. But I'll try to put this in context in the next few slides. I want to address why we use immune therapy for colitis and for Crohn's disease, because this is often misunderstood. What we've come to realize without knowing the cause of IBD is that what we're observing is an overactive immune response. The immune system of your gut is very complicated, and it's there to protect you. So if you get food poisoning, it becomes activated to try to get rid of whatever is driving the food poisoning. In the situation with IBD, the inflammation is being continuously driven either by something we haven't yet discovered, despite years of research, or because you're missing the off switch or something to regulate and turn off the immune system so it can go back to a resting state. So we use immune therapies to treat colitis and Crohn's disease to try and turn down the immune system long enough so your body can take over, heal itself, and get back to its resting state. So our goal is not to immune suppress you. Our goal is to modify your immune response long enough so we can get you back where you need to be, which is why we're trying to figure out ways that we can use stronger therapy to put you into remission and consider reducing our dosing or other things in the maintenance phase of treatment. There are some general principles of treatment for IBD. The first one, of course, is we want you to feel better as quickly as possible, symptom resolution. The second one is to make sure that in addition to that, we're controlling the disease, as I've mentioned, which means getting you to a healed bowel and normal labs. And that means using objective measures like blood tests, stool tests, and scopes. The third goal is developing a customized treatment plan. This has to do with knowing how much of your disease you have, whether you're having more urgency and needs more rectal type therapies, what your individual prognosis and severity may be, and other features about your disease, like does it flare seasonally? Are there times in the year that we should be proactive and modify your treatment in anticipation of a fall flare or a spring flare? And I have many patients where we've started to think carefully and give them a adjusted treatment strategy in anticipation of their seasonal flares. And what do you do when you start to relapse? How soon can we get it under control and do something to change the natural history? The next parts of treatment of IBD include, of course, choosing our therapies. And I've mentioned to you several times now that it's based on how sick the patient is at the time, as well as what their prognosis might be. The general principles are to use our non-immune therapies first when we can, to use organ-selective treatments like that budesonide steroid I mentioned to you, or some of the biological therapies that are targeting parts of the inflammatory pathway, but not the whole body, when possible. And we want to optimize our first therapy. Whenever we need to adjust dosing, we try to do so before we get to another treatment. And of course, we don't want to use steroids longer than a couple months at the most and get patients off of them quickly. We then choose our maintenance therapy based on severity of disease and based on our choice of induction therapy. And then lastly, and very importantly, after we achieve all this, we need to monitor. Chronic diseases tend to drift away from control, and this happens for a variety of reasons. And so monitoring, even when you're feeling well, especially when you're feeling well, is a critical part of what we do. And lastly, prevention is the key to good health. That means vaccination for preventable illnesses like the flu or pneumonia or shingles. It means cancer prevention, which we'll talk a little bit about, and seeing your doctor regularly. So I'm just going to summarize briefly a couple of the recommendations regarding the different activities and severities of colitis. Both the ACG and the AGA have similar recommendations for mild or moderate colitis. They start with 5-ASA therapy that can be delivered either orally and rectally. We know that when you combine oral with rectal therapy, whether it's a suppository or an enema, you feel better faster. Getting the rectum to heal is key. That doesn't mean you stay on the rectal therapy. We know that's not convenient, but that'll get you feeling better quicker. We also know that in milder disease, we shouldn't use steroids unless we really need them. Unfortunately, they are often prescribed early because we want patients to feel better quickly, but we should start with 5-ASA therapies and focus on them as long as we can. Notice that this is again for mild or moderate colitis. If you have severe colitis, these therapies don't work very well and we need to move on. In the moderate or severe colitis patient, we can break this into induction and maintenance recommendations. And I recognize that there's a lot of information here. The first one is that steroids are often needed in the early part of treating moderate or severe colitis. The second is to recognize that when we can, we should use that budesonide steroid before we give prednisone or other systemic types of steroids. Our biological therapies I've mentioned to you are mentioned specifically in the guidelines as appropriate options for induction of severe or moderate UC, as is tofacitinib, the Xeljanz therapy, but its label has recently been adjusted so that it needs to be given only after a patient has already tried an anti-TNF biological therapy. And if a patient's not responding to an anti-TNF, they can go to the vedolizumab, which is Entyvio. They can go to the new therapy, ustekinumab, which is called Stelara, or they can go to Xeljanz. So there's a variety of different things to consider. One more point in the guidelines based on available evidence is that if a patient's treated with infliximab, which again is Remicade, Inflectra, or Renflexis, it's recommended that they do so in combination with a thiopurine. That would be 6-MP or azathioprine. Those two drugs together work better than either one alone. Now, that is presumed to be true for Humira and Simponi, but that hasn't been shown with the strongest level of evidence yet. It does not seem to be true for the other biological therapies, so combining those therapies with others doesn't seem to be needed. For maintenance, we don't use systemic steroids. You should not be on steroids during your maintenance plan. If you're stuck on steroids, something we call steroid dependence, meaning every time you come down on your steroids, you have a relapse of your symptoms, then you probably need an adjustment of your therapy so that you can get to a place where your steroids can be safely removed. Sometimes we need to confirm that the bowel is healed to know that the steroids can come off. And sometimes patients have some symptoms and their bowel is already healed and we're just getting confused and they're staying on steroids when they really don't need to. So this is a really important point you should be carefully considering and discussing with your healthcare provider. Thiopurines can be used as maintenance. That's the 6-MP and azathioprine, and the biological therapies, as we've already talked about, as well as the novel small molecule tofacitinib, can all be used in maintenance. So again, remember what I taught you. Induction is turning off the inflammation and getting the patient to feel better as quickly as possible. Maintenance is about prevention of relapse. If you're in remission and you skip a dose of your medicine, you're still going to be in remission. The longer you're off medicine or using the wrong dose of your medicine, the more likely you are to relapse. So we try to use what is proven based on evidence, the lowest dose of an effective therapy to keep you in remission. And we're working very hard to figure out other ways to do this in the future. So now you're finally in remission, you're in maintenance phase, now what? This is called monitoring, and that's a major advance in our field. In the past, monitoring just meant call me if you're having trouble. Now we're actually much more proactive. That means seeing your healthcare provider on a regular basis, doing some routine tests, including blood and maybe even stool markers, to know that you're in remission. I tell patients it's a little bit like diabetes, where we measure blood sugars on a regular basis and a hemoglobin A1C to know how well the diabetes is under control. Checking the stool to make sure that the disease is under control, routine scopes when appropriate, and blood tests are all part of monitoring the disease and making sure you stay well. In addition, having these healthy visits with your team enables us to talk to you about vitamin D and about diet and exercise and to answer other questions you may have and to update you on things like the new guidelines or new treatments that have come out. It's a very important thing to do. So when we ask our panel, we realize that most patients haven't heard anything at all about markers to monitor the disease. Let's hear this quote.
When I call and I am having any type of symptoms, she will order labs, and I know that she is looking for specific markers. I never have discussions with her about what the markers are specifically that she is looking for. I wish that I did have a better idea of what it is in the labs that she is trying to get.
So I'm very excited to share with you that there are some at-home tests that are going to be available in the near future that will help us monitor your disease without you always having to come to the physician's office or go to a lab. We're hopeful that this will change the way we think about these conditions and empower our patients to know what's going on and when they should be activating their healthcare team to help them intervene and prevent more significant poor outcomes. Now, I have a couple things to address that always come up in questions, and I want to try to do so briefly right now. The first question we often get is, why does a therapy stop working? You finally get on a drug after you've thought about all these complicated things that you heard in this program, and then that treatment doesn't work after a while. Well, there are some different reasons that we consider and that you should know about. The first one is that, remember, we don't know the cause of colitis, unfortunately, and therefore the body is still trying to react to whatever it thinks it's reacting to. And the human body is quite amazing and redundant, so it looks for a new pathway of inflammation. So if we pick one target, sometimes the body then will find a new pathway and work right around our targeted therapy. The second is that you might develop an infection. Even when you haven't been exposed to anything obvious, there is an infection that can occur with colitis and make you go out of remission. The third is that for biological therapies, especially the anti-TNF therapies, there's a risk that your body can develop antibodies against the anti-TNF therapy, just like you would if you got a vaccine. You have an immune response that ends up neutralizing the therapy, and therefore it doesn't work anymore. And of course, the fourth is that the patient stops their therapy. I often remind patients that they are doing well in most cases because of the treatment that's preventing relapse, not in spite of it. And we have some active studies going on now about how we might thoughtfully reduce or discontinue certain therapies and monitor them carefully. But it has to be done under supervision and very thoughtfully based on your risk of relapse and your overall risks. Now, what do we do if your medicine stops working? Well, the first thing is to confirm inflammation. Sometimes people have symptoms, but they're actually not due to a relapse of their disease, and that's very important. The second is to make sure there's not an infection. We always look for C. diff, the infection I mentioned earlier. The third is to find out if the drug that they're taking has still measurable levels. So if you're developing neutralizing antibodies and the drug is getting cleared out of your body, those levels won't be detectable. The fourth would be then to consider dose changes, a short-term fix like a week of steroids, which we know we'd like to avoid but sometimes need, or whether we need to consider cycling to another drug within the same class. That's most often appropriate if the patient developed anti-drug antibodies to the first drug, meaning that those antibodies neutralized the first drug, but the mechanism was still working. And finally, we would consider switching therapies altogether, which we call swapping, or changing the mechanism of our treatment strategy. So this general approach is how we approach patients when the therapy seems like it stopped working.